Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We would like to call to order our regularly scheduled Board of Pharmacy meeting. Today is November 2nd, 2018. The time is now 9:37. We will begin by having board and staff members introduce ourselves. Following that, we will ask members of the public to please introduce yourself. Two things, don't forget to state any organization that you might be affiliated with, if that's applicable, and don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet that's going around. So I will begin with the introductions. I'm Daphne Bernard, board member.
Tamara McCants, board member.
Eddie Curry, board member.
Good morning, Alan Friedman, board member.
Benjamin Miles, board member.
Staff present.
Good morning, Shauna White, executive director.
Good morning, Corinne Barron. I'm health licensing specialist for the Board of Pharmacy.
Good morning, Latasha Gaskin, Health Licensing Specialist for the Board of Pharmacy, CCB.
Good morning, Lawrence
Howard,
Investigator.
Good morning, Carla Williams, Board Counsel.
Thank you. Before we begin, I would like to
ask
the board to please And so we will start over to my right with the gentleman here. If you'll please state your name and, again, if you're affiliated with any organization.
Good morning, Suleiman Ayakubo, Howard University College of Pharmacy.
Denise Faluca, Walgreens.
Andrea Bath,
PGY1 resident with Walgreens and Howard University College of Pharmacy.
Misty
Carney
with Walgreens.
Don Zwar,
Public.
Amara Ikani, I'm the 4th year pharmacy student from Howard University. Currently, I'm on rotation from Walgreens with Dr. Misty Carney.
Shelley Walden with Walmart.
Good morning, I'm Vicki Basilica. I work for ACHP.
Sean McPeterson, Giant Pharmacy.
You said ASHP, right?
ASHP, yes.
Is this the first time you've had an ASHP person?
I was here a while ago to give testimony for the collaborative practice agreements, but I also practice at Children's National as a pediatric pharmacist.
Okay, wonderful. Welcome, welcome to you all. We just celebrated National Pharmacist Month. We hope you did something phenomenal during the month of October. Start planning now for next October so that we can continue to celebrate the profession. So we will begin with our open session. To start things off, we will start with approval of our August 3rd as well as our September 7th open session meeting. So board members, if you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, we'll entertain a motion when you're ready.
Which one was it, September?
August
8th. August 3rd and September 7th.
Okay. I move that we accept the minutes for the August and September board meetings.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions. Abstentions, the motion carries. All right. Next item is the Executive Director's Report. So, Dr. White.
Hello, hello. Good morning, everyone. How's everyone doing today?
Great.
Happy belated Pharmacist Month. Currently, right now, we have 842 pharmacy technicians registered in the District of Columbia, 1,977 pharmacists. Of those pharmacists, 568 have vaccination and immunization authority. We have 221 pharmacy technician trainees. We have 9 approved pharmacy technician training programs. We have 722 pharmacy interns, and we have 1,219 pharmaceutical detailers. I wanted to give some updates from the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. They have some exciting updates coming up in 2018. Previously and currently, when a pharmacist needed to reciprocate to another jurisdiction, there was a licensure transfer form, and that is going to be moved to online coming up in 2018. I don't have the exact release date, but once we do have that information, we will push that out to all of our licensees. Additionally, the CPE monitor that will become an app where you can use that on your phone, and the app will be able to track all of your licenses in all of your states, and will be able to alert you when you need to do certain CEs. It'll have each state's requirements and the expiration date of your license in that state. So we previewed the app at the executive directors forum that NABP had in the 1st of October. So I look forward to that being available to everyone. NABP is also accepting awards for, accepting nominations for awards. One is the Lester Holt Service Award, the Fred Maffery Award, and the John Axton Service Award. So if the board wants to nominate anyone for these awards, please let me know. I will definitely get you the information that you need. Our prescription drug monitoring program is moving forward. Over the past month, we completed a informational module in conjunction with the Delmarva Association. So this is exciting news. Delmarva is working with most of the Mid-Atlantic states to give some audio presentation on PDMP. So this information is on their website, and it should be up on our website soon. Our detailer renewal will be open December the 1st for pharmaceutical detailers. And we'll be sending information out to our detailers in the next few weeks. And additionally, I wanted to update the board on the clinical lab practitioners advisory board. Moda contacted me probably about, I would say, 6 weeks ago, and we had some discussion, and it was determined that they're responsible for appointing this advisory committee. So I was under the impression, they were under the impression that the board was to, through the Department of Health, composed the advisory committee. So I have been working with them to try and get these positions filled over the last few weeks. So they have had some a few changes, and a new person is working with us, Elizabeth Keaton. So as soon as I get more information from her, I will provide that to the board.
So am I understanding correctly that there are still openings?
Right, for the clinical lab practitioners. And that information is on their website for positions on the clinical lab practitioner.
So if we know of people who we might want to recommend,
please,
I can send it to you, and we'll get it to you.
Well, you can give it to me, and I'll give them the link to the website. Okay.
Thanks.
Or you can go on to MOTA, which is the Mayor's Office of Talent and Acquisition. However you want to do it. So I just wanted to update on the board the status with that. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. The next item on our agenda is our Assistant General Counsel's report. So Carla.
Yes, thank you. So just want to give the update that the final rulemaking for the technicians to complete the LGBTQ continuing education requirement, that was published and final on August 4th, so that is now effective. They will be required for their renewal in 2019 to have those additional 2 credits. I think we will be working to make sure there's some information on our website to help people locate those courses. All of the health professions in the District of Columbia are required to do this. And so there will be courses available. So if you have technicians, just make sure they know that when they renew in 2019, they will need to have those CEs. And that's all I have to update you on this month.
Thank you. And that's for pharmacists and technicians?
Right, all the professions. So the other ones had already, I believe, been finalized, and I reported that in August. The only one that was left was technician, and it actually went to final publication the day after our August 4th meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We had a hand in the back.
What was the date again? November the date? You said November the 19th?
No. The renewal period for 2019, which is February 28th of 2019, that's the last date to renew for that next renewal period. Pharmacy technicians are required to make sure they've done those additional two CEs in LGBTQ cultural competency training.
So when they renew in 2019, they have to have had those two additional hours. So for those of you in the audience who want more information, check out our newsletter. Our last newsletter has a nice article about the legislation. So check it out. It's online. You can just Google DC Board of Pharmacy newsletter and it will come up. Any questions?
So as part of the General Counsel's report, would this be a good time to talk about some of the legislation that the council is introducing and whether the Board of Pharmacy might want to weigh in or not?
Is that also part of my report?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I have three things. Thank you very much. All right, so yes, that was item two. So item three, the Removing Barriers to Occupational Licenses Amendment Act of 2017. The council did introduce this legislation, and it really is targeted towards the criminal background check reports. All of the boards are required by law to conduct criminal background checks before they can issue a license. I'm not sure why, but the council has concerns that some boards may be unfairly using arrests against applicants who are applying for licensure. So this law says things like you can't use an arrest if it didn't result in conviction, or you can't use an arrest if the conviction was expunged. Things that we don't do anyway, because you have lawyers advising the boards who tell the boards that you can't use those things against people. But they are recommending a law to be passed that puts a lot of parameters on how the board can review those criminal histories. It will require the boards to share a copy of the criminal history. That's problematic because the information we get from the FBI is extremely sensitive and confidential. There's a lot of restrictions on who we can share it with. So having a law that says we have to give it to them could actually conflict with the federal law that governs the reports. So I am recommending that the board have the subcommittee look at this more closely and decide if we should have testimony to the council, not necessarily to oppose the bill, but maybe to help them more tailor it. I don't know who authored it, but in reading it, it did not seem like they really understood how we handle things over here and what the board actually does. It has a list of things that you have to think about when you're looking at the conviction, such as how long ago it was. We already look at that. How does it impact or affect that person's fitness to practice? We already do that. So it's things that the board already does, and then it also would require the board to have to meet with everyone and give the person an opportunity to present mitigating evidence before making a decision whether or not to deny them. That's due process, which we already do. So it's kind of really just maybe helping the council understand what we actually do and what, if any, parts of the law would actually be helpful, what would actually cause a problem. Because one of the things you have to keep in mind when you bring someone in is they need to understand if this is not their formal hearing, the things, the statements and the things they present can be used against them. So by mandating, I guess, that they have to come, you could be putting them in a position where they're actually working against their own interests. So when we invite people in, we make sure they understand that information, give them an opportunity to bring a lawyer. So the board has a lot of processes and procedures already in place that make sure that everyone's criminal histories are reviewed fairly. There are a lot of people who do manage to get licensed even though they have criminal histories. Usually the people who run into the biggest problems are the ones who lied about having a criminal history versus if you had a criminal history. I can say that without a doubt. Most of the actions that are taken in relation to the criminal history is because you lied about it, not that you had one. So this is on the agenda for the board to decide whether you wish to present testimony on this bill. It's scheduled for, I believe, November 29th, or 28th or 29th is the hearing date. Let me double check. So for discussion.
So, Madam Chair, I had a question, and I read through quickly the proposal, and I may have misinterpreted, but I thought near the beginning, it actually said something about not allowing or no longer allowing the boards or the agencies to conduct criminal background checks as part of the decision for whether the applicant So the board regulating the health occupation shall not inquire into or consider the criminal history of an applicant until after the applicant is found to be otherwise qualified for the license under this title. So I was wondering if they were saying you can run the criminal background check, but you sort of like you have to deal with it after.
But we already do that because the application never comes to you unless they're actually otherwise qualified.
So it's not saying you have to license them and then you can discuss. It's just saying you have to take everything else in consideration and this can't be the only thing.
Right. So I don't think that's really necessary because applications, we already make sure that you've gotten the correct degree or training and certification before you come to the board, and you are otherwise eligible for licensure before the board looks at the criminal history. So that's kind of saying you have to do what you already do.
Okay, so then that makes sense to me. That was the first thing that jumped out at me, and I agree with you. I think there are some caveats in here being suggested that could be potentially a little problematic in terms of our interest in protecting the consumer's welfare, right, and things that we look at. So perhaps if there's, you know, education that by testifying we could, you know, highlight the importance of that background check and how it's integral to assuring that when we're licensing people, it is in the public interest and patient safety.
Absolutely. And for the public, I think it's good to just point out, you know, when our council, when there are amendments that are proposed or proposed rulemaking, there's typically an opportunity for members of the profession, you know, pharmacists or any other stakeholder, to go in and kind of give input into whatever is being considered. A lot of times, if you're not a practitioner, you really don't understand some of the nuances of what goes on in terms of the licensure decision making. So it really is helpful for you know, the council members when they do get the perspective of what some of the concerns might be. So I think, you know, I don't want to speak for our executive director, of course, but I think it really would be helpful for us to be a part of the hearing and provide some, give some conversation around, you know, what some concerns are as they relate to protecting the public. And we are always reminding individuals that that's what our job is. Our responsibility is protection of the public.
And as Carla just so nicely stated, that the current process we have in place really does align with what we believe their intent is. Not to say there aren't a couple of other things in here for consideration, but.
So we would recommend that the board chair or board member.
Absolutely. Okay.
Okay, so is that a motion to draft testimony and testify on this bill? It's November 28th at 11 a.m.
Yeah, I would so move.
Second.
And of course, members of the public, you are able to sign up to testify or submit written testimony, especially as employers, if this is something that you support or don't support, as far as how the board looks at both your licenses and the licenses of the people who you hire. The hearing is open for all members of the public to testify or submit testimony in advance.
Thank you.
I had one more, just an FYI. So the board did take action against a license for Mr. Jackie McCall. He was revoked. He did appeal the board's decision, and the Court of Appeals ruled affirming the board's decision. So that matter is now resolved, and his license status remains revoked. And that's just an FYI.
Can I ask about two other pieces of legislation?
Absolutely.
So, as I understand, the Council of D.C. has also introduced legislation around Prescription Drug Donation Pilot Program Act 2017. And I wasn't sure where that was and whether that's something the board would or would not want to weigh in on.
I think Shauna's involved on that one.
Oh, is that Pharmacy Control Division?
Yeah, it's the Pharmacy Control Division, but I will give an update. I think the prescription drug donation pilot act. That hearing was in September.
Okay.
I think it was in September.
A couple of weeks ago.
I'm getting all the hearings confused. There's so many. Oh, so that hearing was a few weeks ago. The department did provide some testimony through me, and Dr. Bernard did provide some testimony. So basically, we gave testimony that as far as the donations, that most of the residents in the District of Columbia do have insurance, and with that meaning medical insurance and prescription insurance, and we just said we were willing to work with council to see where any gaps existed to ensure that our residents, the ones that didn't have insurance, could get the drugs that they needed.
Okay.
So I don't have any updates. We just had the hearing, and I don't have any updates after that.
Okay. The next one was, and I don't have the bill in front of me, but Sean, I know you're aware, it's the one that would essentially mandate, I believe, that, and again, this is probably Pharmacy Control Division, because mm-hmm. pharmacies
right.
put those drug take-back bins in for consumers to bring back their drugs. And I know there was, I think I heard there was interest in the Control Division testifying, but I don't know if that actually occurred or not.
Right. So we did have that hearing. That was the September hearing. I'm
right.
sorry, I'm getting confused. So council proposed legislation to that would require all pharmacies in the District of Columbia to have take-back bins. I know some of our pharmacies do have them now, and some pharmacies have informed me and other groups in the Department of Health that they do plan to install these take-back bins. That legislation basically would mandate that they would already do that. The Department of Health and Pharmacy Control Division testified that we would like to allow pharmacies to make those decisions on their own, whether they would want to install a take-back bin in their facility or not.
Okay. And just for everybody's information, it was required, and then it was going to be administered by the District of Columbia.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, okay. And then the last one was... let me pull up the bill number. It's Bill 22-0106. And let me just make sure this is DC. I believe it is.
22 sounds like DC.
Yeah, so that would, so already I think there's a provision in place that allows consumers to have up to 12 months of birth control dispensed on one fill. I believe this is amending that language to allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control pill. It talks about contraception, and it defines hormonal contraception for up to 12 months if they do certain things. So one of them is that they go through a training program that's developed jointly by Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine. And they're, I guess, essentially certified to do this. And then there's qualifiers about patient self-assessment, pharmacist assessment, then referring them to either an OB or primary care if they haven't received treatment, or a clinic, and so on and so forth. So it really is about pharmacists prescribing for birth control pills. I heard yesterday that I believe the next markup of the bill is today at 2 o'clock. So that would be Board of Pharmacy, I think, because it's about pharmacist practice, and I wasn't sure if that's something we wanted to be involved in.
Right. So I guess that's the question that if you want to ask your fellow colleagues, if they want to be involved in or want to provide some type of comment.
I think anything involving pharmacy, we need to be at the table. And if what is proposed is true, where a pharmacist can prescribe 12 months under those conditions, like then refer them, then there's some extreme concerns related to that, especially, increased risk of DVTs and so on and so forth, a proper follow-through. So, yeah, whenever, when we find out about the hearing or whatever, we certainly need to write a testimony.
So, Carla, when they just do markups, that's like to get ready for something that will eventually be heard. I don't know if there's been a hearing on this already and they're now doing edits to it for another hearing. I don't know.
A reading, probably. I'm not familiar with this one, so I'd have to look it up to see
okay.
the status of it.
Okay.
But I know on the council's website they do have all the dates that any action, like when it went to committee, if there's a committee report, that's published on there. If they have a hearing or a roundtable, that information's on there. They usually even have the audio or the video on there as well.
Okay.
They take you through all the steps. So I'm not sure where that one is.
Okay, so it's Bill 22-0106, and it's...
That's what you're involved with.
I have some information about it, but I'm not sure. I don't have information as far as, like...
That's not what you're like.
It's defending access to women's health care services emergency amendment act of 2017, which I believe amends what passed a year or so ago, and that was amended from an original law that was put in place in 2000 having to do with cancer and also related to contraception, I believe.
If it's an emergency, then it definitely moves quickly.
Okay.
Give me the number
one more time. Sure. B22. Well, now I'm seeing B22-224.
224? Yes, sir. All right. It's enacted, so the emergency law is in place.
So, Carla, the other number would be
probably the temporary
B22-106.
Is it 106 or 0106?
I have B22-106.
Okay. So this looks like the permanent legislation, which is still under council review.
Okay.
There should be a temporary in there somewhere. They usually, so the emergency laws are in place for 90 days. So usually you'll do emergency and temporary at the same time. And the temporary stays in place for 224 days while you're trying to get your permanent law passed. So this B22-0106 is the permanent bill,
okay.
permanent legislation, which looks like in March they had a hearing notice. There was a public hearing on it March 20th of this year. There's a video available. There's no updates of what's happened since March 20th. I'll check one more time. I imagine there's a temporary in place. Just want to confirm that.
So if I hear you correctly, right now there is a law in place where pharmacists can prescribe oral contraceptives in D.C.
Yeah, there's
I thought that the law, the emergency law that's in place will allow for the physician to write for an insurer to provide up to 12 months of oral contraception. I thought perhaps what they're trying to do is make it permanent, but they're also trying to amend it to make it broader so that pharmacists can also prescribe for the up to 12 months under certain circumstances. That was my read on it. I looked at it last night real quick.
So there is a temporary in place, which is official law, so it's already in law.
Okay.
It looks like they have, that took effect in July, and it will be in effect until February of next year, giving them time to pass the permanent legislation.
And this one involves it's expanded for pharmacists to also prescribe.
So the current law now, based on this, talks about
insurance. Let me see your agenda right now. I just want to see something.
So if there's anyone in the public who wants to do you more background information on this. This is Bill 22-106. If you do a search, you should come across it.
This does not mention pharmacists. This talks about the insurers and having to provide coverage. The individual health plan, the group health plan, the insurer, blah, 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 Medicaid Alliance shall provide coverage for, shall not impose any cost sharing requirements on women for the following preventive health services required to be covered under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Those evidence-based items that have an effect rating of A or B in the recommendations of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Such additional preventive care and screening is not described, blah, blah, blah. Any additional preventive services identified by the Preventive Services Task Force, it shall be construed consistently with all provisions of the patient. This does not mention pharmacy.
So I'm seeing what Carl is saying, that the emergency law B22-224 was effective from April 24, 2017, and the temporary law B22-225 is currently effective until February 21st, 2018. This new draft markup, B22-106, which is the permanent bill, has two additions to it. New requirements to the language of introduced bill authorizing pharmacists to dispense contraceptives without a prescription, and two, requiring notice of new requirements in the bill to patients, pharmacists, and insurers. So that's what's being taken into consideration now, and apparently they're marking up this afternoon for the next iteration of this.
That's a permanent one.
Yeah.
That's permanent.
That will be permanent when it passes, yeah. I guess they have up until February to make that happen. So
that's the one that's shown no action since March.
Is there a link that you have to that particular language that you might be able to forward, or otherwise I could just
I don't have a link, but I have, I think, the attachment to the new the current legislation that's being introduced.
I can email that.
Yeah. Okay, great.
And even though we might not have testified, maybe some other colleagues went and testified.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, a couple things. One obvious one is the potential impact on pharmacist practice, too. And two, that if the Board of Pharmacy is going to be required to create regulations jointly with the Board of Medicine, do we want to kind of look at the languages in the law to make sure it's written in such a way that doesn't, you know, box us in? Like, we had some challenges with some other laws that passed, and then we had challenges with creating regulations based on the way the law was written. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. So it looks like, as introduced, it was really dealing with the coverage requirements, which is probably why we did not get involved.
Right.
But if they now subsequently decided to add these other provisions, it does, it is appropriate. Board to provide testimony. The draft you are looking at is not available on the council website, so you have to contact it.
Okay.
You know people. But we'll get that draft as well, and then I guess I'm not sure when there's going to be a hearing on that one.
Okay.
Since there is still pretty substantive, they need to do a hearing on the table.
Okay.
On those new provisions. So we should be prepared to testify.
But we have up until February 2018 before things really will.
The current temporary law is good until February 2018. I'm not sure when they're going to move on this, but we should go ahead and get a copy of the marked up draft that they're revising and then be prepared to submit testimony.
I think the good thing is, you know, extension of practice to include pharmacists. Great. The concerning thing, though, is that we definitely need to be at the table so that we aren't boxed in and it's more prohibitive to advancing the practice. You can have laws and regulations, but if they don't really allow you to realistically provide the care that, you know, our district residents need, then that's a problem. And so that's why it's important to be at the table. Remember, we always say that if you're not at the table when the decisions are made, you will be impacted by them. And so what you've been hearing over the past several minutes is pharmacists being impacted by what's going on in terms of legislation. So be at the table. All right?
Yep.
Anything else?
I think that concludes my report.
Are you sure?
I've tried three times.
I do have a question, though. Is there anyone in the audience practicing at CVS? Because my understanding is the pharmacies, and you probably know this, the pharmacies in D.C. that do have these take-back bins, they're the CVS Attorney General Racine specifically noted CVS pharmacies that are doing this. Is
no, Walgreens has the take-back bin. And it's two Walgreens. Please correct me if I'm right. I'll let Denise say who has
the take-back bin. At Chinatown Gallery Place, we have one, and then at Metro Center.
And then my question, just a sincere question, is who pays for the disposal of those medications?
We do. So it was an initiative with the DEA they launched. The Attorney General came down in 2015 to really combat. And so far we have 72 tons of drugs that we've taken back in collaboration across. We have it in 39 states currently right now. In the district, we only have it in two stores. But they're full, so much so that we have to increase the cycle of pickups.
And Walgreens is responsible for paying for the disposal.
Yes.
Okay.
We met with Dr. White a little bit. I shared brochures. So it's in collaboration with the DEA and huge initiatives. I know D.C. isn't impacted like Indiana and other places where they see it more forthright, you know, with the opioid crisis. But we have it across in 39 states. We're trying to get it to all 50.
Okay. That's good to know. All right. Any other questions? No? All right. The next item on our agenda. We've heard a lot from one of our subcommittees already, but we will entertain if there's any additional information from our legislative subcommittee.
Yes, Madam Chair. The public comment period closed for collaborative practice. And so just to refresh everybody's memory, there was a law passed quite some time back which allowed for collaborative practice in the District of Columbia. And it was for the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine to work jointly and promulgate regulations, which we did some time back. And then those were published, and subsequently a number of pharmacy stakeholders, no medical group stakeholders, or no physician stakeholders, submitted comments. So the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medicine went through a thoughtful process again and tried to come to agreement on an updated draft regulations. And so had there been no comments received, those regulations then would have been published as final and we would have moved forward and been able to practice accordingly. My understanding is that public comments have been submitted by the deadline. And so the next step would be for the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine to once again take those under consideration and work together to find common ground on whether to make substantive changes or not. If no changes were made, then the regulations as they currently stand would be published as final, and then collaborative practice folks could move forward on it. If substantive changes were made again, they would have to once again be published in the DC Register for another 30-day comment period, and so it continues. So that's where we are, and I know that folks are very interested in moving this forward as quickly as possible and being able to use collaborative practice as a tool to provide, you know, appropriate care to patients. But until we reach a place where the regulations are final and published as such, that cannot occur. So, are there any questions from the board about what's occurred and next steps? Have I left anything important out?
Hal?
Yes, sir.
You said that comments were closed and now there were some comments received. Do you have any dates? I mean, when was it closed and when is it? What are the dates, I guess?
Sure. So the comment period was for 30 days. And it was published as the last day for submission was actually, as it turns out, on Saturday, this past Saturday. So the board now is receiving those comments. And once they're all in and there may be a couple more that trickle in because of the due date, right?
I just want to clarify, since the last day fell on Saturday, it actually went to the following business day, so Monday at midnight, and we were receiving comments up till about 11:54 p.m. on Monday. We have a lot of comments that came in. Some of them, the majority of them followed one template.
Right.
But we have a lot of comments.
Right. So the Legislative and Regulatory Committee for Board of Pharmacy will take those, as we did before, we'll kind of go through them all, compare and contrast the comments between those received and then in relative to what's currently being proposed. And then once again, whatever our recommendations are, Board of Pharmacy will, you know, theoretically go through a similar process, and then we'll have to come to the table with them and try to negotiate any changes that either agency would like to make or not.
I just want to add, the majority of the comments, again, followed one template, and they were just in support. But some people deviated from that and added things, so all that has to be reviewed. Then some came in that were not part of that template, and they talked about things like pharmacist compensation. So all of that has to be reviewed, and then decisions made whether or not changes have to be. So I don't know that this will be ready in December.
What did you say that again?
I don't know that this will be ready in December because of the number of comments that came in, and they weren't all just saying we support this. So okay, it may be the early part of next year before we're able to vote to move this forward to final.
And part of that is because, again, we're dealing with two agencies, not just one. So each has to go through their own thoughtful process and then come to the table together. Okay. And then with respect to naloxone, so the DC Council passed a law which would allow pharmacists to prescribe naloxone. Obviously, you could receive it and dispense it based on a physician's prescription, but this would not necessitate a physician's prescription if certain criteria were met. The primary one is that there be training so that pharmacists who want to participate and prescribe naloxone would go through a board-approved training program, and then essentially they would then they would be able to prescribe naloxone. So the board is in the process of developing that training program, which then all pharmacists who want to participate would take, and we're anxious to roll that out as quickly as we can and make that available to pharmacists. There's other language in there that speaks about standing order and the fact that the pharmacist also has to counsel. And there are very specific points, I think five of them, for what needs to be included in the training, and I believe 7 points for what the pharmacist needs to be counseled on. So I would anticipate that would be part of the training. But that's currently where we are. Any questions?
I have a question. Is there any date around the said training that is going to be available for the pharmacist to take? And is there any language within it for utilizing the standing order to dispense without a doctor's prescription?
So for the first, the board's working as quickly as they can to develop the training material and then figure out the best way to make that available. So is it going to be, you know, are we going to offer continuing education? What form or venue do we make that? Is it through a District of Columbia site? Do we work with AccessRx? You know, there are different opportunities that we've discussed, and it's about figuring out who to partner with and how to make that work as efficiently as possible. Because we do need to assure that people have taken the training, so is there some attestation that's involved? And if it's CE, how do we loop into CE monitor, that sort of thing. With respect to the second, I don't remember the exact language. It does speak about a standing order. In Virginia, Maryland, for example, the state has, you develop a protocol, or they have a standing order based on a state protocol. And there is a physician leader, I will say, who is on the standing order for Virginia, Maryland. So any pharmacist can simply use a standing order. The District of Columbia did not provide that avenue, so it's really to create a standing order with a physician who you're working with in order to prescribe under that protocol.
So if we have a physician,
yeah.
I just want to clarify, for the law as it's currently written, it says that pharmacists can prescribe either directly or pursuant to a standard.
Okay.
Okay.
So the answer is yes on a standing order if there is one.
There may or may not be a standing order. So there doesn't have to be a standing order. You can prescribe directly.
A pharmacist can.
After having completed the training.
Okay. After having.
Yeah. Was there another question in the back? I thought I saw somebody else raise their hand.
Yes. Yeah. How do they get naloxone now? Is there a way for the residents to get naloxone without a prescription?
From a physician.
So, without a prescription. So, technically, sure. Go.
Thank you. So, there are two ways if a resident does need naloxone without a prescription. We do have something through HIPS and Family Medical through our HIV, AIDS, Hepatitis, STD Administration through those two programs. Dr. Roussel, did you want to provide a little bit more information about that?
Well, DOH conducts a training monthly. Right now with community providers, so we basically go over naloxone, the pharmacology laws and statutes, and as well as the how you need to administer and what you need to do with the patient after the administration. So as of right now, we just have those two locations. It's not that it may not change to more in the future, but right now DOH
is for anyone.
Okay. So they have to go to a training to get the naloxone.
So it's only two locations that they can get the naloxone from. So HIPS and Family Medical.
So just point of clarification. So I'm a pharmacist and I care about the public, and I feel like I need to have some naloxone in my pocket or something. So if, am I understanding correctly, I would go to a HIPS location or whatever, do the training, and you physically give me some naloxone to keep on my person. Is that
so,
right?
So DOH, they provide the naloxone to those two locations, but the training is held by DOH.
So, okay, so if you're not a pharmacist at that location, at that HIPS place or something, then
it's
you're
not given to pharmacists. It doesn't have to be a pharmacist. It can be anybody. It could be a community worker that they train on how to administer Narcan.
So it's anybody.
Yeah, but do they give it to you? I understand the training.
So
I'm
give
just
it
trying
to whomever goes to Family Medical and if they need the naloxone kit, they can go to Family Medical or HIPS and get the naloxone kit.
If they've been trained?
Well, there's a training.
The
objective is to train them so that they can use it. But I can't tell you whether or not there's documentation that they've been trained once they accept it, because I'm not that involved in the process.
So the people that are providing it at those locations are trained, and therefore
trained,
they can give
yes.
it to somebody who may be
HIPS
in need.
HIPS and Family Medical are trained,
gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I just want to clarify, so entities that have training programs that meet the criteria of the board, is there a way for them to meet the criteria before, other than with the board's training? Like, can entities meet the criteria and have their own training and then pharmacists be eligible?
So the way the law is actually written right now, it says that the Department of Health is supposed to conduct the training. Not board approved, not anybody else. It's just the Department of Health is supposed to conduct the training. The board has agreed to assist the Department of Health by creating this program and making it available. I believe it's going to be DCRX, which is available through DOH. So it becomes the Department of Health conducting the training. That is the only approved training program presently. And that's the one we're working hard to get up and running.
So the Department of Health training that was just mentioned is not a Department of Health training?
It's a different one. That particular training done through, I believe it's HOSTA,
or CHOP, sorry, which one?
HOSTA, great. HOSTA is for the community support, the community support agencies that give it directly to the members of the community that need it. This training is specifically to train pharmacists to prescribe either directly or through a standing order from the pharmacy.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you for that information.
Alan was giving his report.
No, that's it. I mean, that is our report. Any questions from board members?
All right, next item on the agenda is the communication subcommittee report. So our next newsletter, our December newsletter, the copy is due on Monday. So we have a subcommittee. I see Mr. Curry here, who's a fantastic member and our silent editor, to be quite frank, with our newsletter. So the articles that we're looking at having included here is drug disposal, a pharmacy student perspective or their experience, and the DEA drug takebacks that have been going on. Pretty cool. Also, maybe an article by one of our pharmacists from, where is he from, GW, who was involved in Hurricane Harvey? So sharing the experience of a pharmacist who was on the front lines doing an emergency down in Houston, I think, with Hurricane Harvey. Mm-hmm. And then another possible article is looking at pharmacists in other areas that have been involved in expanded prescriber practices. Some of our colleagues in some other states, especially like the state of Washington, they've been kind of have an expanded practice for a while, including oral contraceptives, and just getting the perspective of another pharmacist. I think one reason it's kind of interesting hearing this or seeing this information in one of our newsletters is because if there's proposed legislation that's going to impact how we do things here, it's sometimes a good idea to kind of hear from someone else's experience. So those are just some proposed articles, but check out the December copy if you want to see what ends up in there. And as always, we remind the public if there are articles that you would like to see more information written on, please feel free to email us. You can contact, I think, Corinne, putting you out there, or look at the DOH website so that we can know what articles you'd like more information on, so that we're addressing your needs. I mean, we don't want to just give you information that we think is good for you. You can let us know what you would like to hear as well. Any questions? Next item on our agenda is an intern presentation on a summary of the NABP newsletter. So when you come up, please introduce yourself. I will scoot out of the way.
Good morning. My name is Suleiman Ayakubu, a student from Howard University College of Pharmacy, 4th year. Today, my presentation is going to be on a summary of various news items that were published in the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy news. So, as an overview, four news items would be discussed today. First being the American Medical Association Task Force proposing cold prescription of naloxone to patients that might be at risk for an overdose. Second item is a new study which has discovered substantial variation in the number and characteristics of pharmacies across the nation. Third news item would be steps that are being taken in Chicago to ease the workload for pharmacies in that state. The last but not the least would be two position statements made by the Tri-Regulator Collaborative addressing electronic health records and prescribe a Breno. So moving on to the first news item, which is about the American Medical Association proposing co-prescription of naloxone to at-risk patients. As a preamble, the task force came up with a statement that opioid overdose has overtaken motor vehicle accidents as the number one cause of injury-related deaths in this country. And according to the Health and Human Services, about an approximation of about 78 people die daily from opioid-related overdoses in this country. They also say that the main risk from an opioid overdose is a previous overdose, because anyone who has experienced an overdose is about six times is about six times more likely to experience another one in the preceding year. And they also say that those accidental opioid overdoses are preventable. So when and why do they think that prescribers should co-prescribe naloxone to these at-risk patients? They consider, you know, they say that prescribers should consider prescribing naloxone when appropriate to all patients that are prescribed opioids long-term to manage their chronic pain, And also, anyone that might be in a position to experience an overdose or witness an overdose should also, can also be, you know, provided naloxone. As to why they think this is a good proposal, they say that it is difficult to judge which patients that are prescribed long-term opioids to manage their pain would actually experience an overdose. Second point that they made was that patients that are on these long-term opioids do not feel they are at risk of experiencing an overdose. And they estimate that about 40% of drug overdoses are as a result of diverted medication. And they think that co-prescription of naloxone with these opioids would help keep the antidote with the drugs for which they are meant. So the case that they make for their proposal is that the task force put out a statement that states that have laws and acted to increase access to naloxone have about a 9 to 11% decrease in opioid-related deaths. And the morbidity and mortality weekly report from the CDC also estimates that currently there are about 644 opioid overdose prevention sites across the country. And since 1996, there have been about 26,000 overdose reversals across the country. And that might be attributed to a distribution of about 153,000 naloxone kits to lay persons across the country. They also say that naloxone is cost effective, and emerging data also suggests that providing naloxone as a component of responsible opioid prescribing may encourage these patients to be safe with their opioid usage. The second news item is a study out of the University of Illinois, which has found substantial variation in the number and characteristics of pharmacies across the country. So just as an overview, the original role of pharmacies have been dispensing. However, their role is quickly changing, and this would include being healthcare resources and points of care. They are also healthcare locations due to their ability to provide enhanced services and engage with patients that they see. They are also ideal locations because they are able to raise disease awareness and give information to patients who they meet at multiple points of contact. Other evolution of the of pharmacies would include screening, vaccinations, wellness programs, and then clinics which provide on-site education events. So, according to the study, the number of pharmacies in the country has between 2000 and 2007, that's when they gathered that data, has increased by an amount of 6.3%. And however, then also the number of pharmacies per 10,000 or per capita did not change substantially. However, they found substantial variability when it came to the localities or the neighborhoods. And per capita, they observed that this variation could be anywhere from zero per capita to 13.6 per capita. And this represents a threefold difference in neighborhoods with the highest quartile of pharmacies and characteristics as compared to those in the lowest quartile. So this is a table from the National Council for Prescription Drug Programs, and it breaks down the progression or retrogression of number of pharmacies from 2007 to 2015. And as I mentioned overall, earlier on, you can see overall there was an increase of about 6.3% when it came to the number of pharmacies in this country between that time period. So the repercussion, or what they found out was that those pharmacies that occur in the lowest quartile were clustered in the Southwest and Pacific West, including Texas, California, Arizona, and New Mexico. And because of that, they think that these neighborhoods tend to have a disproportionately high rates of non-adherence. And these locations are also more likely to encounter barriers when it comes to the availability and the characteristics of the pharmacies that they stay. Therefore, they advocate that policies that that are meant to improve access to prescriptions for patients to take into consideration the availability and characteristics of these pharmacies in the populations or the neighborhoods that they are meant to serve. Next news item would be steps that are being taken out of Chicago to reduce the workload for pharmacists. And this proposal was made by the City Council in Chicago. And what they proposed is that pharmacists not fill more than 10 prescriptions per hour. They also have to post clearly a notice to the public telling them which pharmacists or pharmacy technicians have worked more than 8 hours for that day. Another proposal is to give pharmacists who have worked more than 7 hours 2 15-minute breaks and a 30-minute meal break. They also propose that 10 pharmacy technician hours should be given for every 100 prescriptions filled, and they would prohibit using of staff metrics or productivity quotas to determine the productivity of their pharmacists. Last but not the least news item would be the tri-regulator collaborative coming up with two position statements regarding electronic health records and practitioner burnout. The tri-regulator collaborative is made up of the governing bodies that license pharmacists, physicians, and nurses. So when it comes to their position on electronic health records, they put out this statement in a bid to improve interoperability and uniformity of use across the board. And they say that the seamless transfer of electronic health records would ensure delivery of high quality healthcare and improve patient safety. They also put out this statement because they think that the multiple systems currently being used across the network either provide scanty interoperability and uniformity of use. And then, so therefore, steps must be taken with members of the collaborative to improve uniformity across the network. And also make sure that everybody within the collaborative are able to seamlessly share information amongst themselves. So their position statement on practitioner welfare, they identified four reasons why practitioners might be experiencing burnout. And this would include knowledge overload, social media pressures, rapidly evolving technological advancements, and also changing workplace environments. And what they suggest to deal with these problems is to provide these practitioners with wellness strategies and give them assistance to deal with these the aforementioned causes of the burnout. So these are my references. And are there any questions?
So going back to, I had two questions. Going back to the description that you made about the types of pharmacies and where there were decreased areas, can you go back to the slide? There were areas that found a decrease in the number of pharmacies, and somebody looked at the adherence rate in that area. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was really the next slide. Do you know, I think it was a slide after the table, especially for those areas, do you know what drove the decrease in pharmacies in those regions? Did they say?
So most of those pharmacies are actually in medically underserved areas. Mm-hmm. So mostly they think that it might be areas that are not conducive. Like, mostly they occur in areas where, you know, in, I don't know the word to use, but bad areas. So that is why you have these pharmacy, you know, they call them pharmacy deserts in those areas.
So was this in the context of, what were they proposing as a solution? Were they talking about telepharmacy here or what?
Okay, so there were a couple of things that they proposed. So we're proposing that since most of those areas are being served by independent pharmacies, mm-hmm. so what they were proposing is to give some incentives to pharmacies that want to locate or relocate to those areas, like, you know, making it easier for them to get reimbursements mm-hmm. for drugs that they might dispense. And, you know, most of those areas do not have, characteristics such as e-prescribing. They don't have 24-hour pharmacy services. Those are factors that are tied to adherence to medication. So what they were suggesting is that any pharmacy that is relocated to those areas, they should make sure that they have, you know, some of those services. Since, yeah. you know, some of those patients that might be filling their prescriptions in those areas are also, you know, economically on the lower side. Mm-hmm. So providing those services could also boost the number of pharmacies that relocate to those areas.
Okay. And then to the other one, when you were talking about the prescription guidelines from Chicago, who was it that proposed those?
Okay, so... these proposals are being made by the City Council Finance Committee from Chicago.
So the City Council.
The City Council is making those proposals. There have been pushback against that, because when you look at 10 prescriptions at an hour, yeah. I think that is inappropriate. So I think they should leave that to the individual, because if you are in an area where a very busy area, let's say you are in Chinatown filling prescriptions, 10 prescriptions per hour might not be appropriate. So that would even leave most patients' prescriptions unfilled. So that is one drawback of their proposal that I see.
I think it would require them to hire more pharmacists.
Yes.
Do you know where this came from? Was it just one member, or
it was one member that I've forgotten his name, but he was the one who is pioneering this this proposal. Yeah.
With regards to bullet number 3, what are they currently practicing as far as the amount of time that they work straight without breaks?
So there are some pharmacies that don't, you know, even though it's on the books that the pharmacies take breaks, they really don't. So they are trying to put it into law. And they are also trying to put a law for pharmacies who don't adhere by their proposal. You could be fined anywhere from $500 to $1,500 a day if you don't, you know, go by this proposal. So, I mean, it's something that they are putting forward. Any more questions?
So, do you think this was proposed because of some issues that they've had in Chicago with prescription fills, like deaths or severe issues with drug interactions that aren't being caught by pharmacists?
Yes, it is. That was one reason why, you know, because to improve safety when it comes to you know, filling those prescriptions, because they think that rushing through, you know, some pharmacies rush through filling those prescriptions, and they are unable to catch very tiny drug interactions that they would otherwise catch if the workload wasn't that high.
Any more questions?
So I actually have a question. So is this more towards retail pharmacists or hospital pharmacists?
No, it's more towards retail pharmacists.
Okay.
Yeah, not hospital pharmacists.
Is there anybody in the room that thinks that the proposal in the current language really will see the light of day? But great presentation. Thank you. I'm sure some of you in the room can attest to this too. I've had one patient bring in 10 prescriptions at one time. So filling 10 in 1 hour. Love it. All right. Thank you for that. Next item on the agenda is really some of the same information that you just heard from the NABP newsletter. And for the sake of time, I probably won't get into just repeating some of that. I do want you to know about a couple of drug recalls, one involving oxytocin. I'm not sure exactly where the product was distributed. Let me at least get the two companies for you. Give me 1 second. If there's anyone in the audience also who is following the FDA's Drug Supply Chain Security Act, DSCSA, which has been talked about, I think we've been talking about that a lot for about 2 years now or something. There is a open session for individuals to come in, get more information and give comments. That's going to be taking place in December. Unfortunately, the registration for that ended October 27th. The next open session will be February the 28th, and I'm sure they haven't opened up registration for that. So again, if there is anyone in the room who's been following that closely, check the FDA's website so that you can make sure to register for the February open session if you're not going to be attending the one in December. And although you might not attend the one that's in December, there's still a comment period where if you want to make public comments, you can certainly do that. Believe it or not, some of this is tied into the opioid crisis that we're having. There's a lot of thought behind if we can better track fentanyl, as the real fentanyl that's coming from the real manufacturer to hit the pharmacy, then we can cut down on some of the illicit products that are out there. Some have a different opinion about that, but I just wanted to note that some of this really is tied into what we've been discussing recently with the opioid issue. In terms of the recalls, okay, so PharmMed Services did a recall of oxytocin that was compounded with lactated ringer solution. The issue with that is because there wasn't enough oxytocin that was in the product, so it will be ineffective. It's not as potent as it's supposed to be. So just be on the lookout for that. And that's made by PharmMed. And the other product, Hospira, they have recalled certain lots of hydromorphone by Hospira. And that's a potential, not proven, but potential good manufacturing practice issue, because they found when they were inspected after the fact, there was a faulty filter that they found. So any products that were made, we have to just assume that they have been adulterated. So they had to do a recall on those. So I wanted to make sure that you are aware of that. There was one other thing that I don't think you mentioned that I want to make sure. You know, with the hurricanes and the issues that have been coming up, I think some of us, we kind of started thinking about this when Katrina hit New Orleans. There's an article about the governors in Florida, Alabama, Georgia, and I want to say South Carolina, right? Yeah, South Carolina. All five governors putting emergency legislation into effect about the practice of pharmacy during an emergency. For example, you know, during Hurricane Harvey, for those pharmacists who just really felt compassionate and wanted to jump in your car or on a plane and get down there and help, if you're not licensed there, are you able to help? For those patients just showing up to a on-site clinic that's there for emergency services, can they just come in and say, hey, I need a refill of all four of my medications, when they have no documentation? I think it's time for us to kind of start thinking about what the standard will be for how we will practice, how we will be able to assist within the laws when there's an emergency. And I thought this was an interesting article in terms of how the different governors in those states responded. For example, they allowed emergency refills. Some did 72 hours, some expanded it to 30 days. And then there's always this talk of enabling out-of-state licensed practitioners, pharmacists in our conversation, to come in and still practice and be under the protection of the law in case there's something, you know, some kind of liability. So I thought that was interesting. We see these things that are going on around us, and sometimes we want to sit back and kind of take a look at what would happen and what would be the guidelines for us to be able to assist if needed. So that was interesting information to see from the other states. Other than that, I think we will now open up our comments from the public. Before we do that, I saw about four people. Actually, two of the people were here and they're gone now. there were some people who came in after we had introductions. So if you did not have an opportunity to introduce yourself, please do so at this time. Again, I'll remind you to please state your name. And if you are affiliated with any organization, please state that as well. And don't forget to sign the sign-in. I will start with the gentleman in the yellow mustard shirt.
I'm Deron Hall. I'm the operations manager for Maxwell Pharmacy. We manage Whitman Walker, Unity, and Murray Center.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Kim Greenwood. I'm from downstairs. I'm the adult immunization coordinator with the immunization program on the third floor. And I wanted to pass out and let you all know that the Department of Health and the Omaha Foundation, who's probably using Jennifer Thomas, that normally comes, we've been collaborating over the past few years. And we've come out with media, social media, and communications media for the flu and pneumonia season. So I'll just pass around some of the things that are going to be shown. It's going to be posted on the Metro and in your Express Metro paper that you get, as well as on the bus and the Metro ads about the flu and pneumonia. And we have also a little video that comes out from Department of Health. We've seen it sometimes on Workplace. We have a Workplace Facebook that's been shown, and it's being shown in some of the different doctor's offices. So it's running from October all the way to February of 2018. And if you go to any DC movie theater at Gallery Place or Dupont Circle or different areas, it's also like a commercial that comes on before your movie about the flu and pneumonia and what's here in the district.
Okay, thank you. Good information. All right, so now we will entertain comments from the public. If there's something that you like to share with us, please feel free to do so at this time.
I have two.
So, and for the record, state your name.
Denise Faluca with Walgreens. So in addition to the drug take back that Walgreens has, we also have an initiative, hashtag ends with us, to help combat the opioid crisis. So it's a corporate responsibility, social responsibility that Walgreens has really picked up, hashtag ends with us. And then the second thing is, I'm licensed in Oregon. You mentioned earlier about Washington State and the prescriptive authority. If anyone's interested with the oral contraceptives and concerned over that, there's actually like a flow chart because they actively do it right now. So you can go to the Oregon Board of Pharmacy website and they actually have a flow chart if oral contraceptives, just an FYI before February 18 to prepare. It'll say state the age, when the last time they did it, for pharmacy to have prescriptive authority. There's a neat little flow chart.
What's your name again, sir?
Denise Faluca.
So that would be great if, you know, assuming the bill were to move forward and pass as written or in similar structure, for the board to create regulations. I also heard a presentation at a Virginia conference recently where there are also resources there that have similarly helped pharmacists put together processes similar to what you're describing. So I think that would be really helpful.
It's really neat. When I got it, I was like, wow, this is really cool, because it basically, the concerns that you were having, age, certain concomitant disorders or anything like that, it kind of is a neat little flow chart. So
great, thank
just
you.
Just thought you guys were
out of curiosity, what's the maximum day supply that they can prescribe before they actually go in to be seen?
So it depends on several variables, mainly age, last checkup with a doctor, you know, several components. So there's not one blanket. It depends, you know. It's a neat flow chart. If you look at it, you'll see, oh, wow, this kind of everything comes together.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Other comments? Don't tell me we put you to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Just my concern is over.
Students in the room. If you're a student, can you raise your hand? Pharmacy student? You're here, though, right?
Yes.
Any students working at Walgreens right now? Are you at Walgreens?
So I want to thank Dr. McCants for pulling together a meet and greet with the Howard University students for the Board of Pharmacy. Mr. Curry and Dr. Miles and I attended along with Dr. Bernard. Dr. McCants was there, of course, and it was a chance for the board to socialize with Howard University students. And before we actually got into the auditorium for the formal questions and answers, we were surrounded by students who peppered us with all kinds of questions about what we do on the board, what our responsibilities are. I think there was an assumption that this was our full-time job and that we didn't do anything else. So we talked about our roles on the board, and we talked a little bit about what we do outside of the board. And they were very interested in the different avenues that pharmacists could travel. And then we went into a formal meet and greet where they again asked us some questions. There was a lot of conversation about the importance of, as pharmacists, being involved in your local associations and how that can help affect legislation or regulation, so have a voice. There was a lot of mention made about the disconnect sometimes between the various pharmacy associations and not everybody being on the same page, and how physicians and nurses in particular are so well organized and have a strong voice, and that's something that perhaps pharmacists could do a little bit better. But very encouraging to hear about, you know, people wanting to get involved with their associations. And we talked about our different practice environments. So anyway, great opportunity to, you know, meet with our students, and the fact that they were interested was really cool as a board member, and perhaps there'll be an opportunity to do that again further on and even bring more people in the class involved. So thank you, Dr. McCants, for
putting that together. Thank you guys very much for answering the call to come down to campus. It's one of the, when we went to the regional meeting, that's one of the main points that they were discussing, was more collaboration between the schools and the boards of pharmacy. So I definitely think we should put that in the newsletter so we can show people what we're doing here in D.C. But thank you all very much for coming.
I think some people took pictures, big group pictures too.
So I will not miss an opportunity to remind everybody, September 20th through the 22nd, mark your calendars, 2018, we're about a year out, a little less than a year now. The District of Columbia will be hosting the region, the District 1 and 2 NABP AACP combined meeting right here in DC. We have not hosted in years, and it's going to be phenomenal. It will be at the Hyatt Regency Washington on Capitol Hill. We already have a block of rooms available. That's probably irrelevant to you guys because we're here, so we're going to, well, I know for me, I'll be commuting there every day. But I think those rooms are going to sell out really fast. DC is a very popular destination, and we plan on having an awesome meeting. We really want to do something very different this time around compared to what we just experienced when we were in Connecticut. We expect to see a representative from all of our pharmacy schools in District 2. We're talking about, I think, 30? I think between District 1 and 2, about 32 or so pharmacy schools. We want representatives there. We want students there. We're thinking of a poster presentation with a reception. Haven't worked out all those details. But the bottom line is, don't miss it. So again, that's September 20th through the 22nd, 2018. The District 1 and 2 combined NABP-AACP meeting at the Hyatt Regency in Washington on Capitol Hill. It's going to be wonderful. Any other comments from the public? I kind of just jumped in here and started talking about anything. No? All right. So hearing none, we will entertain a motion for adjournment from one of our board members.
Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move to the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matter pursuant to 2-575B9, to seek advice of counsel to the board, to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 2-575B4.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, now we'll take a roll call vote. Starting here.
Tamara McCants, yes.
Eddie Curry, yes.
Alan Friedman, yes.
Benjamin Miles, yes.
Okay, thank you. So that will conclude the open session portion of our meeting. Please feel free to join us again in January.
December.
Is that amazing? Oh, we're going to have a December. Oh, yeah, because we missed.
Just with the makeup.
See you in about a month. So first Thursday of December, whatever that date is. Thank you.
Thank you.